Peter Lamont, here we are in your office at Edinburgh University. Can you tell us what do you do here? What do you do?
Over there is where I sleep. otherwise, I teach. I do research on the history and psychology of magic and the paranormal.
Now, we've known each other for a long time.
Too long.
Too long. But can you tell us how you got into that? Bit of an unusual position.
As a kid, I was a magician, like yourself. So I've been long interested in the production and reception of magical stuff. How do you make things convincing? What fools people? What doesn't? What do people make of these things? And so in psychological terms, that would become deception and belief, roughly speaking. In historical terms, it's not just magical stuff, but psychic stuff, spiritualism, mesmerism, psychical research. How are all these phenomena produced? How are they made convincing? What do people do with it? What do they make of it? Do they believe? Do they not believe? Why? And so on. So I'm asking a whole range of questions that you are, but from a historical perspective.
And in terms of that belief issue with magic, do you think it's fair to say most magicians tend to be pretty sceptical about the paranormal? No, not all of them are, but do you think there's a feeling that scepticism tends to go with an interest in magic?
Well, that's the feeling, except, of course, there were some surveys a while back by Marcello Luchuzzi, who we both knew, and that suggested a slightly different pattern. And it depends, of course, what you mean by the paranormal. So I think a lot of magicians may be open to things like some versions of ESP, or perhaps coincidence and fate, and all these categories become kind of fuzzy. But the big stuff, PK, macro PK, I think most magicians are sceptical about that.
Are there notable exceptions to that? Are there well-known magicians in the past have endorsed? I mean, going back to the sort of the era where you focused a lot of your research in Victorian times, are there well-known magicians endorsing seance room stuff?
Lots of big magicians. Howard Thurston said that Palladino couldn't explain how Palladino did what she did.
So Palladino was an Italian physical medium.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, but Palladino was a very famous medium in the history of psychical research. Was an Italian peasant woman who was studied, investigated by some very famous people, the Curies, for example, and by well-known psychologists and so on, and by psychical researchers. And the pattern seemed to be that sometimes she was caught cheating and sometimes she wasn't. And when she wasn't caught cheating, people said it was because it was genuine, and other people said, no, you just didn't catch her cheating. So she becomes this really interesting character who some people still, very intelligent, well-read people, say, yes, she cheated on some occasions, but she didn't cheat all the time. Sometimes it was genuine. And to a lot of us who begin fairly sceptically about these things, that's quite a strange position to try and get your head around. But it's logical enough. You just have to start from a different place. So anyway, one of the ways in which people say Palladino was real was they appeal to certain authorities. And sometimes it's scientific authority, and sometimes it's conjuring authority. And this has happened for a long time. So what happens is people say Howard Thurston, one of the most famous magicians in the world, he couldn't explain how Palladino did what she did and ruled out trickery. And therefore, it could not have been trickery, therefore it's real. So Thurston would be a classic example with Palladino.
Thurston, presumably fairly well versed in magic. And so how do you account for him thinking that there was something there above and beyond deception?
Sure. I mean, I think the first thing which has to be said is one possibility is that she was genuine at certain times. Another possibility is that she fooled Thurston through deception. Is that possible? We don't know exactly, but yes, in general, of course it is. We know as magicians that magicians regularly fool other magicians. But there's another aspect as well, if you stay with the it probably wasn't real position, which is that sometimes when magicians make public claims, they're not always entirely sincere. Like Houdini is a classic example. He got loads of things wrong, and probably deliberately, for reasons. John Henry Anderson, the very first magician debunker, that weird brass neck Aberdonian, who first pulled a rabbit from a hat and went on to do much worse things. Anderson just made up lots of stuff. You know, P.T. Barnum was a big admirer of Anderson. So Thurston and Keller as well. Harry Keller, another very famous magician at the time, who preceded Howard Thurston as the biggest magician in America. He said skeptical stuff, but he also said that he couldn't explain other stuff. And he famously said of Indian magicians, there was stuff there he couldn't explain as part of his biography. Now, maybe that's what he really thought, or maybe he's trying to sell books and get publicity and increase box office. So there's a whole range of fuzzy factors involved in when people say these things.
But another area of your research has looked at Victorian spiritualism, and that's obviously when it began and when it grew very rapidly. Can you talk through some of the factors why you think that was the case? What was the appeal of spiritualism at that point in history?
Well, people have communicated with the dead for a very long time. At least they've behaved in the
way. I've seen some of your shows.
The communication of different types. And why what they call modern spiritualism, which was different from so-called primitive spiritualism. These things are always kind of big general explanations, and one of the classic ones that historians come up with is due to the so-called Victorian crisis of faith. So, 19th century Britain, scientific findings seem to be challenging Christian faith. Geological findings challenging the age of the Earth according to the Bible, which is a position that people like Isaac Newton used to hold, as well as many other people. So, on the one hand, then, you've got the age of the Earth according to the Bible. You've got evolutionary theories appearing, most famously Darwin's, challenging, again, the story of the Bible as history. So biblical truth is being challenged by science, and this causes a lot of thinking. People to doubt, to question their faith, to what some people have called a crisis of faith. And so the story goes, in that crisis of faith, they look elsewhere for something to hang on to their faith, and spiritualism comes along and it says, look, we don't just tell you about an afterlife, we've got evidence of an afterlife. So spiritualism, very heart of it, was the idea that there was evidence of an afterlife. That's what it was based upon more than anything else, and that's an attractive thing at a time when you'd like to believe in an afterlife, but evidence is challenging that idea.
And do you think there's anything in this notion that the Victorian times, there's a lot of advances being made in terms of communication, in terms of the telephone and so on, and that somehow that maps onto spirit communication as well? If you can communicate over a long distance, then maybe you can communicate with the dead.
Sure. So this is another thing that the historians more recently have gone with, the idea that what spiritualism seemed to reflect was another form of communication at a distance. People have pointed to the telegraph in particular at the time, same kind of period. Similar scientists are interested in the telegraph and interested in spiritualism as well. Cromwell Varley, for example, he worked on the Atlantic telegraph, where you can communicate with people in a different continent, and he went to seances where you can communicate with people from a different world. So Things were less clear-cut. The boundaries that we now have between natural and supernatural, between science and what some people call pseudoscience, they were different and less clear at the time.
And when Faraday did his table-turning investigation, suggested it was all unconscious movement. Do you have any sense, when you read that literature, of that being a surprising notion to the public? Because I think the idea that you're unconsciously pushing the glass on the Ouija board or whatever is kind of a bit obvious, but I don't know whether that's because I'm looking at it in this day and age and whether the public in Victorian times just simply didn't think of that and were therefore surprised by Faraday's discovery.
Yeah, I mean, it had to be an unusual idea to them, no way it's not to us, because the whole notion of an unconscious was a relatively new idea. I mean, everyone knows, post-Freud, everyone knows about the unconsciousness, and whatever you think of Freudian knowledge, Freudian views, the unconscious is, everyone has a sense that there's such a thing as the unconscious, and it's responsible for things of which we are, by definition, not conscious. But you trace these ideas back, and you see them coming out in things like mesmerism, It's the mesmerists who start talking about there being different levels of consciousness, trance states and so on. And of course, ideomotor action, which is what William Benjamin Carpenter first came up with as a theory for table turning, the thing that Faraday tested. He came up with this idea in the 1850s. This was part of a growing idea amongst physiologists or psychophysiologists at the time, that there was something going on in the brain which was what we would call unconscious. So this is all pre-Freudian ideas about the unconscious. People are just starting to talk about it as a thing, and the idea that this might be responsible for movements must have been a fairly startling idea. It must have been one of the reasons why people found it so convincing as something else, as a force, or as satanic, or as spiritual.
And just to move on to the final topic, you've written The First Psychic about D.D. Hume. Do you want to say a little bit about Hume and who he was?
So Hume is interesting to me because he's one of those guys, more than Palladino. I think we spoke about before about Palladino and many people being convinced that she was genuine, but she was caught cheating. Hume, I think, is far more interesting because he was never caught cheating. And he did, I think, far more impressive things, according to witnesses. So you read this stuff as someone who's sceptical and you think, well, how do you explain this? Now, lots of sceptics have written about Hume. Debunkers would be a better term. And the stuff they've written has been generally, wrong. They have misrepresented the evidence in order to present Hume as somebody who can be explained. But I've been into magic for a very long time, and I've studied Hume probably as much as anyone alive, and there's some things I can't explain. So he's interesting for that reason. In terms of who he was, Hume was a Scotsman. He was from near here, near Edinburgh in Curry. He was from a poor family. He went on to become one of the most famous people in Europe, in America. He became a spirit medium, and he became the most famous medium of the 19th century. He was hated by Charles Dickens, he was defended by Thackeray, he was avoided by Michael Faraday, Charles Darwin was keen to test him, Tolstoy couldn't stand him, but he was a friend of Mark Twain. He conducted seances for Napoleon III and for the Russian Tsar. He even married a goddaughter of the Tsar. His best man was Alexander Dumas. He became a hugely famous person from a remarkably poor family.
And it's materialisation type phenomena primarily, was it, in the seances?
It was not so much. Well, some, yeah, some. He up until whom you had raps, you had messages, and one or two other sort of strange bits and pieces, but Hume had a remarkable range of phenomena. So spirit hands would appear and tug up people's dresses and trousers and so on. And large tables, we're told, would levitate, and musical instruments would float in the air and play. On one occasion, a piano floated with the pianist still playing it. He elongated his body, he handled red-hot coals, he was clairvoyant, and he himself floated to the ceiling. That's what people tell us, and no one caught him cheating. And so if you don't believe in this stuff, you have to try to come up with a good reason for not believing. And that's what I think he's really interesting. If you're open-minded about it, it forces you to understand the nature of your scepticism.
And just to return to that point you said before, you've read probably more about him than anyone else alive, and you've got the background in magic. What do you really think was going on with some of those things that are tricky to explain?
Most of it you can look at and say, well, you know, it could have been this, it could have been that, but you're not sure. Some of it, I don't know. You end up with things like, well, let's say, for example, there was a seance in Amsterdam in 1858 where he was challenged by a group of sceptics, of Dutch rationalists, to produce phenomena. And he went to Amsterdam, and he did. And he sat around this table, and this huge dining room table floated in the air, and they couldn't stop it floating, and he made it so heavy they couldn't lift it. Now, that's what the rationalists tell us. And they said, we don't believe it's real, we just can't explain it. And neither can I. Now, what have you got? Was it some trick table? How would that work? Did he bring a trick table along to the hotel in Amsterdam and sneak it in without them noticing?
The old heavy trick table.
That's right, that which you buy in Brussels, in a way. Did he have lots of stooges that the rationalists didn't recognise? Was it drugs? It was Amsterdam a long time ago, but were they making this up? It's quite hard. Was it hypnosis? So what have you got? I don't know. I find it really interesting that it's just not clear what went on. Not just that, but you've, let's say, the people who reported it actually lied or had phenomenally bad memories. Is that more plausible than the idea that a table can levitate? And that's what you're left with. So what was going on, I don't know, but that to me is precisely what's interesting. Like, I don't know what went on.
And people can read all about that in the first psychic book.
If we're plugging the book, yes.
which I was. Want to look at other work, they search on the Edinburgh University website. They can find some of your papers and things there.
Yeah, the website on my publications are mentioned there.
Excellent. Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.